This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Almost every week, Radio EcoShock details our headlong flight into a complex series of environmental, economic, and social disasters. But where are the solutions? There are many answers out there. What we need is a collection place to gather the things we need to know. Enter Lawrence Beaumart and the Bank of Real Solutions. Beaumart is a longtime New Zealand activist who founded the successful Environmental Business Network in the 1990s. And along with a group called Living Economies, Lawrence co-published and wrote for the book Fleeing Vesuvius, Responding to the Effects of Economic and Environmental Collapse. Lawrence Beaumart is currently on a tour of North America with our previous guest, Nicole Foss. Lawrence, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, hello, Alex. Thank you. And hello to your listeners.
Lawrence, most of the doomers I track picture New Zealand as a place to run after Fukushima or the economy blows up. At least New Zealand could feed itself. Is it all a green garden party there down under?
Well, it does make a great little arc by the fact that there are only 4 million people in an area the size of England, which has over 60 million people. We've got lots of food, but even in the Shire, Alex, the dark shadow of Mordor casts its shadow. Yes, indeed. We have an ex-Merrill Lynch investment banker as our prime minister now, and he's ready to hoover up every last bit of goodness there might be there, but it's not all on his side. But yeah, it's a beautiful place, although here in these northern parts coming up the coast, it looks pretty good up here too. But we do have a small population. It's a great place, and we've pioneered many things, like first country in the world for women to get the vote. We went anti-nuclear back in the 80s, and we've done lots of things like that. And top of the pop charts in America at the moment is a 16-year-old New Zealand girl who's told all those little Disney skanks that they should clean up their act and be real young woman, and that's pretty impressive. So we're pretty outspoken, as you can tell.
And speaking of parties, tell us about the political party you co-founded.
The New Economics Party, near the end of 2011, 5 weeks out from the general election, myself and Deirdre Kent, a woman in her mid-70s who'd written a book on the monetary system, realised that no one, including our very strong Green Party there, was representing the economic equation. So we thought we needed to put that on the table. So, yeah, we threw that together and went out there and publicly promoted the concepts of the new economy and what's wrong with the old economy.
Well, I do want to talk about solutions with you, but let's peek at a few challenges. Would you care to name your top three things to worry about?
I worry about my own sense of optimism and my own attitudes. That's, you know, so it's the micro internal level's the first thing. My concern mainly is the combination of factors. If any of the fault lines in the system, you know, we've got a lot of pillars that are the structures of our modern lifestyles, and I'm concerned about several of them going in a domino effect at the same time. The geopolitical tensions are big. You know, how that then impacts on the price of oil. When the price of oil was $147 a barrel, a lot of our world doesn't function when oil is that expensive. And if it goes even sillier and sadder in the Middle East, you know, it could be $200 or $300 a barrel. Back in 2008, due to the economic crisis, I mean, a lot of the pillars of the free market economic system basically failed and collapsed, and they've managed to fake it and kicked the can along the road since then. But, I mean, global shipping wasn't moving for 3 weeks there in 2008 because no one could trust a letter of credit. When AIG, the world's biggest insurer, was failing, well, you can't run business without the insurance industry. There's a whole chain of effects. And if you go into the extreme climatic effects, which are only going to get more extreme, I mean, they affect, you know, world food sources. And when people don't have food, that affects both their social fabric and their economy. So, you know, it's a long, long list, Alex, but you're probably as good at picking it as me. But I'm worried about one thing banging into the other, that we get several shocks at the same time. But overnight, the economic system can fail. As the people of Argentina found back in 2001, overnight, kaboom, gone. You can't trust your monetary system, or more recently, the people of Cyprus. And that's a sudden adjustment. And that takes a lot of resilience and adaptability. And some people are going to do better than others in that situation.
You've pointed out there are a lot of answers out there. There's solar, there's biomass, there's community currencies, and you have a proposal, and in fact it's working right now, the Bank of Real Solutions. How is that working out for you?
Well, that's basically a website that allows people to upload their local community can-do success story. So the way I see it is as a bit of a recipe book. And I think if everyone has the recipes, then we can all bake the cake. There's always a tragedy of these best solutions that exist and the lag, the time lag between other people picking it up. So it's an extension of kind of what I've been working on for 20 years, which is looking for information on the solutions and bringing that forward as fast as possible and getting it out to as many people as possible. And then looking for ways to give them strategies for action. And so I'm looking at the moment of taking the Bank of Real Solutions into the World Bank of Real Solutions and making it a slightly more complex but fluid platform that many people, a sort of an open source system that many people can link up around bringing forward the best ideas and then looking for funders, workers, people who want to work on those solutions. And I'm looking at upgrading it the next notch. At the moment, it's just in New Zealand. It allows for people to find their local initiatives under a variety of headings, be it health or education or energy and the like or money. It's worked relatively well. It's a good experimental platform, I see it as, for what it can be next. I had a guy in Portland contact me who wanted to use the platform to set something similar up there in Portland. So I want to develop the platform for locals so that anyone around the world can set up similar initiatives. It's amazing how in any region, people often don't know what's happening down the road. So I'm a keen fan of getting the best information into everybody's hands as quickly as possible. And I have played with the extension of that. I have an outline for in New Zealand to get a 24-page mini magazine into every letterbox in the country. I've always looked at all the junk mail and thought, well, what about getting something useful into the hands of people? And so I'm playing with all those ideas of how do you get the information into everybody's hands and what is the best information? Because really, if we used all the best practices we have on the planet now, most of our problems could be solved very quickly.
Well, I'm going to put a link to that Bank of Real Solutions website in my blog at ecoshock.info because I took a look at it and there were some exciting things there that I went, well, I've never thought of that and that could work here. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Lawrence Baumert, the environmental and local economy activist from New Zealand. Lawrence, your speaking tourmate Nicole Foss told our listeners an economic collapse will come well before climate change devastates what is left of the economy of everlasting growth. What is your take?
Well, as I mentioned before, the 2008, basically, you know, that was a bit of an Enron moment. Everybody thought Enron would be there forever, and one morning they got to work and it was all over. It turned out you couldn't run it on horse manure and marketing forever and fraud, and it was gone. And a lot of the mainstream Wall Street and banking system is really an Enron-type Ponzi scheme, and we're just waiting for the next wave, which Nicole says very clearly that was the warning shot across the bows was 2008. So the big moment of reality, the reality ledger is coming. There's the next one coming. So how soon that is, I'm not quite sure, but I'd be surprised to see us on some kind of economic recovery in 2 years' time.
Tell us about the book you are involved with called Fleeing Vesuvius, Responding to the Effects of Economic and Environmental Collapse.
That was actually originally produced by FASTA, an Irish economic think tank back in 2011 in response to the economic collapse in Ireland, and we did a New Zealand edition of it. You know, in Ireland, they were one of the first European countries to hit the reality wall from their false economy, and they bit the bullet and brought in austerity measures to try and get things in order. In their first year after their austerity measures, their GDP dropped by 17%. They had to tell their police to buy their own uniforms, and they dropped their benefits, their social welfare benefits, by 5%. So that was a bit of a rough landing for Ireland, and that's going to be an ongoing thing. Because it doesn't put your economy into recovery when it drops by 17%, I mean, if America really bit the bullet on its budget deficit, it could have to do budget cuts of over $1 trillion in a short space of time. You can only imagine what that would look like. So the book was a response, the byline, a response to economic and environmental collapse. A big part of it is we're no longer just trying to create a sustainable world and avoid the effects of unsustainability, but we actually have to deal with the effects of unsustainability. They're upon us. This is the future. What's happening now is what people for the past four or five decades have been waving their hands around saying, stop, the trajectory we're on, all bad things will happen. Well, this is it. We're here. We're here now, and we've got to deal with it. We've got to do both things at once. We've got to try and build a better, more sustainable future, and we've got to deal with the disruptions that come with hitting the limits to growth.
Can you give us a couple of examples of solutions being tried in New Zealand that are already working?
Some of our local community monetary systems are working really well. We have time banking's taken off. Time banking in the town of Littleton, which was where a big earthquake hit, which leveled the surrounding city quite hard. It is a very robust and resilient system that's building a strong community where people, for doing voluntary effort and doing services in the community, are able to get credits, time credits, for the time they put in. And people are able to build a community chest of time credits for working on community projects and helping the needy in the community. People are building credits for phoning in and on elderly and isolated people in the community, or helping people who are in need in the community. People are able to get a credit for helping meet those social needs, and in turn they can use those credits for things they need, be it childcare or gardening or plumbing or those sort of things. So time banking is a really fabulous initiative that's taking off all across the world. We've also got a let system in the place I live in, Golden Bay, New Zealand. And we have our own paper currency and electronic banking. 10% of our regional population belong to this system. And that allows us to have an increased liquidity in our community for both building businesses, business activity, and meeting social need. And we have a system in New Zealand called Barter Card. And with just 4 million people, we have 7,000 businesses like architects, lawyers, people who own hotel chains, and providing accommodation. These people, 7,000 businesses use this business-to-business system of a non-dollar system, and they use, you know, ATM swipe cards, electronic banking, and that allows for, you know, increased business activity. So it's a real tool for economic development, especially in harder economic times where cash is short.
You know, in the United States, Lawrence, we're seeing shadows of collapse already. Detroit went bankrupt. The federal government is currently shut down. Food stamps stopped working for a few hours, and there were many riots. Is there still time to organize and launch local economies?
Well, it's not an option. And people can, because there are off-the-shelf systems. If you go to ces.org.za, it's a website that comes out of South Africa, and hundreds of let systems around the world are using their platform. It's not that sophisticated, but it's very adequate. It's a great electronic system, and anyone could set up a local currency based on that today. We put out a book, Get a Handle on Hands, which is available as an ebook for $3 that anyone can use, which is a 136-page manual on how to run a local currency. Nicole and I were featured in a book called True Wealth, which you can find on awholenewworld.com. True Wealth, which is the whole culture and thinking of community currencies. So there's a lot of information. There's Bernard Lyotard, his writings. He's put out a lot of books on people money, Thomas Greco, and then there's Margaret Kennedy and the book by Edgar Kahn, No More Throwaway People, about time banking. So there's lots of information. Living Economies, website le.org.nz, is a powerhouse of information. Yes, people can set up a currency overnight, and in the, you know, the resiliency for eternity, the transition town type thinking, one of the number one survival tools, I think, next to food, is and communication, which I think is the number one that people communicate with in their community in a time of crisis and make sure they can look at their food source, is currency. Because with currency, goodwill will only go so far. But with currency, then people can get entrepreneurial and innovative to meet the needs of the time. Then people can, you know, revamp their workshops and the like to start making, bringing forward the types of technology and services that you need. So there's a great book by Michael Schumann, an American, called Local Dollars, Local Cents. And that is a template for regional economic development, which tells how people, if they pull their money off the planet-killing Ponzi scheme, which is Wall Street, and invest it in the local economies, over $2 to $3 trillion could be put into the regional economies of America. And that could all flow into things like, you know, the whole new healthy local food revolution, which would answer a lot of health needs. It's an exciting opportunity. I'm not a doomer as such. I'm a realist, but I think the crises we have are the opportunity for change and to throw off some of the old systems. You know, I don't think it's the end of the world as we know it. I think it's the end of a world we no longer want or need, and that doesn't become 21st century humanity. So it's an opportunity now for people to move fast into other systems because our butts are on fire. So we don't have a choice, and we don't change when we're comfortable. The opportunity now, all across, from coming up the Californian coast, Northern California, Oregon, Washington, now moving into Canada, all I see is people doing really good things. You know, the mainstream might still seem to be asleep, but people are doing just this multitude of things, and they're springing up all over the place and multiplying like a good seed bank does of ideas and solutions. I think it's a very promising time on the planet.
Lawrence Bomart, what is next for you, and where do people go to find out more about you and your projects?
Well, I've thrown out some of those websites, but I'm about to start putting out a newsletter, and whereas they can contact me through the realsolutions.org.nz website, they can email me on lawrencebomart@extra.co.nz. That's Lawrence with a U, Bomert, B-O-O-M-E-R-T, at extra without an E, just xtra.co.nz. And I'd, love to share information with people. And I'll be producing a newsletter soon as I revamp my Bank of Real Solutions into the World Bank of Real Solutions, which will be a, global information sharing platform with a bit of a Kickstarter component, with the mission of best information into action to as many people as possible, as fast as possible.
You have been listening to Lawrence Bomart, the New Zealander looking for answers to our combined economic and environmental threats. He runs the Bank of Real Solutions and helped birth the book Fleeing Vesuvius, Responding to the Effects of Economic and Environmental Collapse. You can find more links to the work of Lawrence, including YouTube videos, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you, Lawrence. Please keep in touch as things develop or even as they fall apart.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Since gaining her PhD in environmental engineering and moving to Stanford University, Sharon Gurji has specialized in the impacts of climate change and food production around the world. Her latest co-authored paper was published in Environmental Research Letters in June 2013. Its title tells us something important for everyone who eats: global crop exposure to critical high temperatures in the reproductive period, historical trends, and future projections. Sharon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
I was introduced to this subject by an unlikely source. A hippie YouTuber from Texas, if you can believe that, complained his garden flowered but set no fruit because nighttime temperatures stayed too high just at that critical time. Is that related to the paper you published?
So I just published a paper looking at trends in exposure to extreme heat during that critical reproductive period for crops, and then looking into the future to how we expect this to change in the coming decades. So you're absolutely right that the reproductive stage of crops when they flower is that very risky time where if the flower doesn't get fertilized and set into a grain or a fruit, then you're not going to have anything to eat at the end of the season.
So it's not just that it's getting hotter, but it's when it gets hotter that counts for agriculture. Is that right?
Well, again, the reproductive stage is an especially risky time because, if the flower doesn't set, you'll have no yield. But it's also true that warming temperatures are also impacting crop yields through other pathways. So, for example, warming temperatures make crops develop faster. And so if they have less days in the season, they gain less biomass and also have less yield at the end of the season. But that's sort of more of a gradual change and more of a, you know, less noticeable change than something like the grain never sets and again, you have nothing to eat.
Right, I get it. So, well, Lester Brown from the Earth Policy Institute has stressed some major crops, including rice, are already near their temperature limits. What have you heard about that?
Well, it's true that a lot of our major globally traded crops around the world, wheat, corn, rice, and soybean, are already grown near their temperature optimums, and in many cases and in many regions, above their temperature optimums. But I think it's good to make a distinction between temperature limit and optimum, which is to say that if it gets warmer by 1 degree, yields are going to start to decline, but they're not going to fall off the cliff. We're still going to have something to eat. And there are adaptation measures that people are already thinking about proactively to help mitigate some of these declines. But it's definitely something that we need to be thinking about.
And you've published research on efforts to increase wheat yields. It sounds to me like the focus has been on the high production areas with less work so far on the most climate-threatened zones. Is that an accurate perception? And also, a second question, are GMOs the only solution?
Well, those are very difficult questions. I mean, I think, you know, more and more people are starting to think about climate change and starting to factor that into their future planning. So you do have very active plant breeding efforts around the world to try to prepare our crops for future climate conditions. A lot of this is classical plant breeding. It's not necessarily GMO. A lot of this is done by, there's an international network of centers called the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. And they do a lot of classical plant breeding. They were behind the Green Revolution in Africa, in Asia, mostly in Asia and Latin America that helped increase yields. So they're starting to think ahead about future climate conditions. The paper I published on wheat, what we found was that to date, in the last 30 years, there hasn't been a ton of progress in helping to improve yield potential for wheat in the hottest areas. It's mostly been in the areas like in Northern Africa and South America, where there's already relatively optimal conditions. Places like South Asia, where they're already growing wheat at really hot temperatures already, there needs to be more of a sustained push to try to help develop the future germplasm that's more tolerant to future climate conditions.
Sharon Gurgi, let's get into the details of your recent paper. Maybe we should start with the historic trends. What are the trends in crops related to temperature?
So again, my most recent paper is on looking at these trends in exposure to extreme heat during the reproductive period. So I just want to stress again that this is not looking at all the combined global change and environmental change factors that are impacting yields and you know, how yields are going to change into the future. It's just looking at that reproductive stage. We did look at these four major crops that are referred to earlier, wheat, maize, rice, and soybean, and we looked at all of their major harvested areas around the world. And we found for the last 30 years that there has been a sustained increase in exposure to extreme heat during the reproductive period, especially for wheat and especially in Central and South Asia, which is increasing the risk of production in these areas. For corn, we also found some substantial exposure, but it was in more kind of isolated, scattered regions around the world. For rice and for soybean, we haven't seen a lot of exposure to date, but looking forward into the future using climate model projections, we start to see large nonlinear increases in exposure to reproductive extreme heat for rice and also for corn in tropical areas, because again, a lot of these areas are already growing these major cereal crops near or higher than their optimal temperatures, and there's going to be an increased risk of crossing these critical thresholds in the reproductive stage.
Well, some of this research must use climate models, and they have been criticized by climate skeptics. How good are the models?
Well, this is a very good question. So I think the million-dollar question people want to know is, what is going to be the impact of global climate change on yields 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now? So you have multiple layers of uncertainty in trying to answer a question like this. The first is the climate models themselves. Now, the climate models are relatively robust at large spatial scales, and especially when it comes to temperature. They're less robust at looking at what's going to be the rainfall change in, say, the state of California, 30 years from now. That's a little bit a harder question that climate models don't have quite a good handle on right now. Then you get into the layer of climate, of crop models. And crop models, again, have been, they've been developed for different purposes over the years. A lot of times they were developed for the farm level to aid in management decisions. And they're calibrated to the range of current climate conditions, not necessarily, you know, what's going to happen in the future and what's going to happen over large spatial scales. So there's a lot of work to be done in improving the crop models. And then finally, the third layer of uncertainty comes down to how are farmers going to respond to some of the changes we're anticipating in the future? And farmers are adapting all the time to changes in market conditions and climate conditions. So they're going to be able to mitigate some of the projected damages that we may be seeing coming out of the model. So there's multiple layers of uncertainty. And a lot of the times it comes down to what question are you asking? And is it a tractable question that it's possible to answer given the current state of our modeling capabilities?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with environmental scientist from Stanford, Sharon Gorgi. We're talking about your food supply. Sharon, tell us about your trip to Nicaragua in September 2013.
Well, I had a great year, and I actually just finished up a year as a Fulbright scholar in a new program called the Fulbright Nexus Program, which is focused on doing applied interdisciplinary research to address sustainable development challenges in the Western Hemisphere. So as part of this program, I had the opportunity to spend 3 months in Colombia this year at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, which is one of these CGIAR centers I referred to previously. And while I was there, I got involved in a project looking at the impacts of climate change on maize and bean production in Central America. And then as part of that project, my contribution was looking at some historical government statistics on yield in Nicaragua and correlating it with weather data in the last 30 or 40 years to see up until now how much has historic climate trends in the region impacted maize and bean yields and what are farmers doing to adapt. So I did have the opportunity to visit Nicaragua. I was there in January, and I went just a few weeks ago, actually in September, and I had the opportunity to visit farms in the Northern Pacific Dry Corridor in the province of Madrid. Also, I went to a farm in Granada, which is 2 hours south of Managua. I also had the opportunity in January to go to the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua and talk with people working on sustainable agriculture in that region. I also had a number of meetings with government agencies who are providing the data and also obviously know their country better than anyone and who are able to help explain some of the trends that we're seeing in the data and, you know, potential options that farmers may have in the future to cope with these changes.
And in your slide presentation, I was astounded to learn the forest cover in Nicaragua has been slashed to just one-third of what it was in 1980. So it's not just climate change in these factors of agriculture, but that must impact local weather and ecosystems too. How does deforestation feed back into climate and crop yields?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it's something that's important for people to keep in mind. So global climate change is happening, and as a big, large world, we need to think about it. But there's a lot of trends happening on smaller spatial scales around the world as well. And in the tropics, deforestation is a big one. So like you said, Nicaragua has lost a third of its forest cover, and this has had large feedback effects actually on regional climate, apart from changes in global greenhouse gases. So, for example, you see a rate of daytime warming in Nicaragua, which is about 3 times higher than the global average in the tropics since the 1970s. And this is a clear consequence of deforestation in the region. Deforestation is also likely changing some of the rainfall patterns in the region, you know, leading to a longer drought period in between the two main rainy seasons, maybe a later start to the rainy season. It's a little harder with the rainfall to tease apart the impacts of deforestation versus some of the global forcings, but there's likely to be some kind of impact. And the other thing about deforestation is that it tends to reduce soil infiltration and increase surface runoff. So you end up with less soil moisture and larger problems with soil erosion, which is already one of the biggest problems facing farmers in Central America.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Scientist Sharon Gorgi will be right back to talk to you about climate change and your food supply. Stay tuned.